Good morning and welcome to Your Pet Matters and the Collaborative Vet YouTube and podcast show. I'm your host, Michael Dr. T. Tequila. And I don't even want to tell my special guest the last time we talked, but it's been years.
Wow.
So I have a great special guest here. He's been on the show before. He is my go-to dermatologist, phenomenal guy, business owner, entrepreneur. He owns a business called Derm for Pets. He's got four locations in the Jersey area. And the guy is just, I mean, he's so busy and I'm glad he has resonance now because he's just, it's a one-man show that's so tough to do to meet all the demands of the derm cases we have. My special guest today is Dr. Ian Spiegel. Ian, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
So, you know, it's funny because I interact with the techs that work for you and I get a little bit of the feedback of the type of situations you're dealt with and everything. But a lot of the skin issues we deal with are just allergy based. And if you don't know this, 90% of the cases that walk in the door of a general practitioner are usually involved in either behavior and or skin, no matter what they come in for. They could come in for vomiting. And we're looking at their skin and we're finding issues there. And so then when those skin issues become problematic, or in many cases, we as primary clinicians, we're not trained that well in skin issues and it becomes a little problematic there. And then we have to turn to the experts like Ian. So Ian, let's just talk about skin issues and allergies in general. And what sort of advice would you give to pet parents? And what sort of advice would you give to, let's say, new grads that are struggling with this whole concept of skin and dealing with, at what stage do they do things? At what things can they prevent issues? And what stage they need to see people like you?
Yeah, I would say one of the biggest things that I see with the clients who come in is they're just frustrated because allergies are frustrating. Because one of the things that will happen is they ultimately will respond to treatment, you know, even general practitioner, dermatologist, whoever, but inevitably they relapse as soon as medications run out, tapered, stopped, et cetera. And I think part of it is educating the client that it's a chronic disease and it's not something that you get once and it goes away. You know, it may go away for a little bit, but most of the time the signs will return. And usually we see that as pets, when they're younger, it may be the allergy signs may be more seasonal, but then as they progressively get older, it may become an all year round problem or multiple seasons instead of just one. But I think really that what I deal with a lot of is the frustration of the client. And just because, you know, they see the dog itch, they smell the dog in the house, it keeps them up at night when the dog is scratching all night And so I think that's part of it, that the owners are inconvenienced by it. So they're frustrated as well. I think as a general practitioner or a new grad, I think what's frustrating is probably that these cases aren't always straightforward. And there's a lot of different options out there now. And it's also knowing how to use those options and when to use those options that's important. And the other thing is that I know in general practice, you know, I don't know, you can tell me how much time a new case gets, but I can't imagine they get more than 20, 30 minute slot. And it's very hard to cover allergies in 20 or 30 minutes. For instance, our consults, we spend probably at least 45 minutes to an hour, maybe not direct time with me, but between myself and my nurses, we're with them for over an hour. So by the time they leave, they know what's going on. And I think they realize how much time it's going to take on their part to manage the case and what it takes to kind of educate them and so forth. So part of it is general practice. I just don't know if they have the time for some of these really complex cases. And I often tell general practitioners to make, you know, like an allergy time slot and block off too, and, you know, charge a little bit more for your time. I mean, I think that's reasonable to the client and for the pet. So.
And so what's your take on these? So since last we talked, I mean, things like Cytopoint, the injectable, you know, monoclonal antibodies come out, and honestly, the Apoquel and everything like that. So what's your take on these new approaches? And do you feel that primary care physicians are overusing? I don't want to say abusing, but like it's an easy, quick fix for some of
it
them,
is,
right?
It is. So Apoquel, which, you know, the oral medication, Cytopoint injection, and then there's also, you know, Cyclosporin atopica. So there's more on the horizon as well. So there's definitely, you know, because allergies, like you said, 90% of cases that come in probably have some form of something, whether it's an ear infection or licking at the toe or, you know, something, you know, every pharmaceutical company is trying to look for that next answer for allergies for dogs and cats, which is nice because there's research for cats as well now. But, you know, I would just say with those treatments, I think that they're all reasonable. And it's, but again, it's really knowing when to use them. For instance, like all those treatments, Apoquel, Cytopoint, Atopica, they don't really have anti-inflammatory effects. And so if a dog is really severely affected or severely infected, so affected or infected, you know, usually you really have to get the inflammation down and get the infections controlled before you bring on board the Cytopoint and the Apoquel and so forth. And that's one mistake I do see is that they'll, you know, the patient will come into me and inevitably, it's funny you can bring those up because almost every history now, yes, they've seen Apoquel. Yes, they've seen Cytopoint. And I'm like, and then the client's like, we've tried everything, nothing works. And that's not true. It might be that they will work, but we have to take, you know, a few steps back, make sure there's no parasitic disease, make sure yeast is which is very common, yeast infections are managed and bacterial infections are managed and the ears are managed. And once we get them back to what I would tell the client, like a normal baseline for the dog or cat, that's when I bring on board these other treatments. And that's not to say that dogs can't get Cytopoint or Apoquel right away. It's just that most of the cases, and again, I see more of a population that is more severely affected than say the general practitioner. So, but for me, when I see the cases, it's rare that on the first go, the first appointment, that I'm just going to say, we're starting with Apoquel, we're starting with Cytopoint. I mean, it's usually not the case, but we do, but usually there's other things to take care of first.
And so, what role do you think topicals play? Because I know compliance can be difficult in many of these patients. And then the duration of topical, you know, I love shampoos. They work great, but it's the limited time frame they work. And then the, depending on the dog or cat, well, yep, that's almost impossible to bait the cat, but the dog and the temperament. Yeah. So what's your take on things like that?
Yeah. I mean, that's a great question. So I think, you know, compliance is a huge issue with anything we do, actually. Even in human medicine, compliance is a big issue. But inconveniencing clients by asking them to bathe their pets. I've had clients come over there saying that they're told to bathe their dog every other day. And I'm just like, that's not happening. There's no way it's happening. And they know it's not happening. And I'm just like, that's not going to do the trick. So, and you know your client too. I mean, is it a person who isn't able to do that for one reason or another? You know, do they live alone? Is the dog 100 pounds? And, you know, they don't, you know, things like that. So I think you have to know your patient. But, you know, overbathing is also not the best thing in the world either. You know, you take a long coated breed, they bathe them, keep the dog wet, and then the coat stays wet and then get an infection after the bath. So it really does depend on the case. But I think that oral antibiotics, oral antifungals for a lot of these more affected cases is a game changer for these patients. I mean, literally, I'll see dogs who were horrible for 5 years and I see them and all I did was treat with antibiotics maybe a little bit longer than they had been previously, or I cultured and looked for a resistant infection, or I found yeast and said, you know what, let's treat with an oral antifungal this time instead of just the medicated shampoo every other day, which you're not doing anyway. And so I think that it makes a big difference. So I always see topical therapy, yes, it's helpful, but I always see it as an adjunctive therapy, usually not, at least initially, as the sole therapy, you know, and I feel like that's the best thing I could say about that.
Awesome. Awesome. And then let's talk the dreaded ears, because I get a lot of chronicity with ears. And then the struggle is, okay, what is the cause of agent here? And what do we do? And then, you know, a lot of primaries are going, okay, let's try one type of ear med. Let's try another. Let's do another. And then we worry about resistant infections and everything like that. So what sort of advice would you give both the homeowner, that the pet parent, is how to manage just their ears in general, and then what primaries can do before getting to a difficult scenario?
Yeah. So I think ears are, again, frustrating for clients and for veterinarians. But one of the issues we get with the ears, just like I'm sure we get, or I see we get with the eyes, is that can the owner medicate the dog or cat? Can they get the drugs in the ear? And, you know, a lot of times the owners are kind of like, oh, every time I try, the dog tries to bite me, or, you know, this and that. And so that's one issue you get, is a patient who's not going to be cooperative for that sort of stuff. And I will say that over the recent years, we do have some products that are more of a leave-in type of product, where you go to the veterinarian, they put a medication in the ear, and it could last anywhere from a week or 4 weeks, depending on the product. And honestly, depending on how severe the ear is affected. But one of the issues I find with the leave-ins is that I don't really feel they're as effective, because even though they claim they last for a long time, I don't really feel like that's always the case. And the other thing is, for a really severely affected ear, expecting those treatments to work is a long shot, to be honest with you. But, you know, if the dog's going to try to kill the owner or the vet, I mean, you really have no choice. So it's better that than going to surgery right away, you know, to address it surgically. But one of the things I will say about ear treatments is there's a lot of options out there for veterinarians to prescribe to the patients, for the owners to use. The issue I see is a lot of those pre-made, you know, approved products that are on the market is that they come in a small volume usually for the amount you probably ideally need for a dog. I mean, you have a severely affected Cocker Spaniel or a Newfie, and they give you a 15 ml bottle or, you know, that's like not enough for like maybe 5 days, honestly, if you give the right amount in there. So a lot of times I find us doing some compounds, and I do see a lot of general practitioners doing that more and more, which I think is great. And there's nothing wrong with the products on the market. It's just that when a dog is severely affected, they just may not be ideal. They may not target everything we want to target. They also often are a lower concentration of the active agent we want. And also we want to make sure that we get in the ear a good amount of corticosteroid to take that inflammation down to allow the medication to be effective.
No, that's great advice. And is there any way like the client can do things at home, like as far as what's your take on cleaning the ears, you know, during a treatment protocol? Because I hear different things about that.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, it comes back to compliance again. So, you know, quite honestly, when I prescribe topicals or ear meds, I'll say, for example, like clean the ears 3 days a week, because I want them to really do it. But I know that probably half the clients, that's once a week. And that's better than just saying once a week to them, because then it'll never get done. So, and I'm just as guilty as everyone else. I am not judging any client or any veterinarian on this. I'm the same way. But I do think with ear cleaners, you know, one of the things is not overdoing it, because we don't want to constantly have the ear, you know, saturated. And that's why there are a lot of good products out there that have drying agents within the product. So you can, you know, talk to the veterinarian about that. And the other thing is there are some products that are more acidic, some products that are more basic or neutral. And then there's, you know, some products that have, unfortunately, a fair amount of alcohol in them. And a lot of those tend to be the over-the-counter products. And there's a reason why, you know, an ear cleaner may be much cheaper. And it's probably because there's really nothing in there but alcohol and a couple of ingredients. And if you've seen some of these ears, and I know you have, but I'm saying to clients and so forth, I mean, you get these really ulcerated ears. You know, you wonder why the dog runs away. Nobody wants alcohol poured in their ear with ulcers in there. And you know, so again, choosing the right products at the right time. But I preferably use products usually that are more of a neutral, basic, alcohol-free type product, because it doesn't tend to irritate them as much.
So what do you think about hydrogen peroxide and vinegar?
So yeah, I think a good question. Hydrogen peroxide and vinegar, I think it's not actually so bad. We do have people do that, and even just vinegar, like a vinegar 50-50 with water, and you know, the peroxide is not as irritating as alcohol, obviously, but it still can be irritating. But I think that those are fine compared to some of the other products out there. And I should mention, because I forgot to say this, is I think it's also how you flush the ear. So you get this bottle, and some people, you know, go up to the dog, squish this, you know, try to squirt this whole thing in their ear, and it's cold because it's been sitting in the garage or something, and forget it, they're out of there. So I usually tell them, keep the ear cleaner at room temperature, or even slightly, you know, at a warmer place in the home. And instead of trying to squeeze all the material, you know, the product out of the bottle into the ear, actually take a couple cotton balls or a few cotton balls and saturate them. And then take the cotton ball up to the ear and kind of massage them and gradually start squeezing it into the ear. And that does two things. One, it does work better because they tolerate it. But two, you don't contaminate the bottle. Because if you take an infected ear and you put the nozzle of the bottle into the ear, you can get bacteria back into the bottle, and it can grow bacteria. And that definitely happens. And then every time you clean the ear, you're putting bacteria into the ear.
So. Awesome. I'm so stoked, because that's what I tell clients to do. I say, warm it, soak cotton balls and do that. Yeah, so I'm stoked. Yes. Coming from the master. I love it. The other thing we're seeing a lot is we're seeing a lot of, not necessarily the disease process, but I see a lot of attached ticks, right? And in my neck of the woods, there's still that thought that using using the tick and flea products is only 6 months a year. So what's your take on that? And then let's delve into like the parasites that they can actually get on the skin.
Yeah, so good question. Definitely parasitic or anti-parasitic treatment all year round is recommended. So I agree with you. And you know, it's for more than just fleas and ticks. So we do see ticks all year round, and fleas certainly, if they're even in the home and you get a warm enough day or the heat's going, those fleas can come out of almost like we call hibernation stage and you can get fleas, you know? So certainly I think the products are important. Now, a lot of the newer products on the market, mostly the chewable and some of the topicals as well, contain something called an isoxazoline. And that's really a newer drug class of vet medicine. And honestly, it's been a game changer for vet medicine, you know? And I know any product that comes on the market, if you look on any website, you'll see this one's killing dogs, this one's doing that, never use this drug. Honestly, none of us would ever take a drug, and no dog would or cat would ever be given a drug if we, you know, looked online for anything. So, but these products, these isoxazolines, which are mostly oral, there are some topicals, they don't just kill fleas and ticks, because one of the things they'll do, and they're not necessarily on the label, but they kill mites. And with a lot of allergic dogs, they may have mites. And in this region, in the northeast region of the country, there is a high fox population. And fox and other wildlife carry sarcoptic mange mites. And dogs can get extremely itchy with that. And it may be a dog who never was itchy before is now all of a sudden itchy, or that even the owners can get itchy with that, the family members. But you can also have an allergic dog that now got scabies, and now you're kind of like just treating the allergy, but it's actually scabies on top of allergy. But what I'm getting at is that these products kill sarcoptic mange mites. So if a dog got exposed to it outside before they became clinical, the mite would die. So that's a benefit to using it all year round. And then there's also another mite that all dogs have, but should really never be found, would be Demodex mites, which live in the hair follicles naturally. And, you know, people actually have them too, but it's their, you know, every species has their own population. They're not actually usually transmitted from one dog to another, but a lot of these allergic dogs, they have a very compromised skin barrier. They're at risk for not just infection, but they're also at risk for Demodex. And if they're on an isoxazoline, their possibility of getting Demodex is extremely low. And, so that's another benefit to using those products all year round. And as a matter of fact, when I get a really itchy dog who comes in and they're not on any preventative, or they're on a preventative that maybe isn't so great, one of the first things I do is I say, hey, we should try this, because this could be the answer to a lot of our questions about this itching, you know, and it does make a huge difference.
No, that's an excellent question. And then can I put you a little on the spot? Because I think first when these products came out, like, in sarcoptic, Brevecta was number one. And then, so I, like, which one would you say to the primary care physician? So if we're dealing with a sarcoptic mange, does it matter? Can it be NexGard? Can it be Brevecta? Can it be Simparica? Like, which one, is there something that you would say, hey, I would try this?
Yeah. So all the isoxazolines should be and are effective against sarcoptic mange. I will say the Brevecta has a label of every 3 months versus the others, which are every 4 weeks. So once a month. And I would say with sarcoptic mange and even Demodex, I don't know if Brevecta every 3 months would be as effective. So I feel like if they're on Brevecta, I do say to them, maybe you should give it every 2 months instead, if we're trying to treat the parasitic stuff. But I will say, if I get a case that comes in and they're severely affected with sarcoptic mange, I will not only treat obviously the itch and treat the infection, and I will throw at them one of these isoxazoline treatments like the NexGard, Brevecta, Credelio, you know, et cetera, Simparica. I will often still incorporate maybe selumectin, which one of the products that you know about that is Revolution, which has been our sort of go-to for decades now. And I feel still it actually helps speed up their response. And so I will often have them do a topical, you know, maybe every 2 weeks for three treatments, just as an icing on the cake, sort of let's get rid of this thing. And excellent. Between that and the other, you're going to kill any scabies mite that's possibly there. But, you know, the times have changed, though, because in the past, when we would see Demodex, they would be getting, like, I'm sure people have heard of ivermectin, because during COVID, people were taking ivermectin for for COVID. But ivermectin was like, we were giving that to these dogs every single day, or for scabies, like twice a week or every week. And, you know, it's a lot of ivermectin that we were doing. And you could see neurologic side effects with giving all that ivermectin, but it's definitely been a changer. And, you know, I've been telling, you know, my resident and people that work with me, you know, when I started my residency almost 20 years ago, you know, we would see Demodex mites like every week, every day, severe cases. And now it's like, if I see a Demodex mite, I get everybody to come look at it, because some of these people have never seen it except for in a book. So these treatments have made a huge difference. But you know, I think, you know, parasitic treatments are important. And as far as the oral ones that you were mentioning go, between all the isoxazolines, I think they should be pretty equal. So I think it's really veterinarian choice. My only issue is with one of them, which is the Bravecto, and it's a great product. It's not a bad product. It's just that it's labeled for every 3 months, when if you read the package, it actually claims it doesn't kill all ticks for more than 2 months. And so I just feel like it's a little bit of false advertisement, and that tick can actually cause a tick-borne disease like Ehrlichia, and that can happen, and it does happen. So that's my only issue with it, is I wonder if it should be labeled for every 2 months personally, but that's really just my own feeling. So
interesting. I'm going to talk to my BI rep now.
Yeah.
Hey, can I put you on the spot? How do you feel about, like, there's a lot of talk, clients go, I don't want to use this because of seizures. What's your take on these orals and some of these orals and the risk of seizures?
Yeah. So I think that if they have a history of seizures, then I do not use those products. And I think it's just because there's been enough information out there that does suggest it's not a good idea to use it. That's not to say, I've definitely had dogs that are taking these treatments that have a history of seizures or on seizure meds. So it's not to say it's every case. I would say it's more of a, what we call idiosyncratic reaction, which is, you know, 5,000 dogs can take it, one gets it, one starts seizuring on it. But, you know, I don't know. So I don't not use the drug, but if it is a dog with a history of neurologic disease, I will try everything else possible. For example, if it is a dog with scabies, I would just use the selinectin. Like, I would just go to the Revolution versus trying those other treatments. And but there are some owners that are absolutely adamant about not using these chewable treatments. But at the same time, one of the deterrents for flea and tick prevention over the years has been the client didn't want their children or their family exposed to the products, like the topicals and the collars. And one of the benefits to the chewable is they're not exposed to it at all, which is fantastic. And the other thing is, a lot of these dogs that have allergies, we talked about this earlier, are getting baths maybe once a week or every couple of weeks. And that, no matter what these topical flea and tick preventatives claim, they're not waterproof. And especially with summer coming, you have, you know, dogs swimming, whether it's in the ocean, the bay, or in a backyard pool. If they're swimming every day, those topicals are not working. So one of the benefits to the oral is they're working, which is great. So that's, you know, something to keep in mind.
Yeah. Awesome answer. Okay. Why don't we talk about, I was trying to figure out how to introduce this, but we talk about these internet tests, or these mail away tests for allergies and everything like that, and the efficacy of them. And it's not like it's these pregnancy tests, right? The pregnancy tests are pretty darn accurate, right? But, or the DNA test, like even the DNA test, the swab test and everything. Yeah. They did the article where twins set the swab test out and were found that they had different lineages so they don't really know what the DNA status is and everything. But what's your take on these home kit allergy tests versus doing a proper blood test or test via you? And do you still do skin testing?
Yeah, we do. Okay. We do a lot of intradermal testing. Yeah. So as far as the testing goes, what your veterinarian or what the veterinarians are using are usually a serology or blood test. And there's definitely reputable veterinary-based companies out there. So your veterinarian is probably sending it to a good lab. There are good ones out there. So those are reputable. And I will say those tests are good for environmental allergies. So things like grasses and trees and weeds and molds and dust and feathers and mites and, you know, all that sort of stuff that's out there. But they're still pretty questionable on the food component of it. And yet every large company does offer that. And, you know, when you talk to them, they kind of, their answer is, well, everyone else is offering it, so we offer it. But if you pull them in a room, they're kind of like, yeah, we don't really believe in it all that much. So, so I usually, and I have to fight with owners sometimes. I'm like, I'll run the blood test for you for the food, but I'm not going to believe the results. And it's really a waste of your money. And so 99% of them don't run it, but then they go home and do the lab, the test online. But anyway, I'll talk about that. So, as far as the blood test go, I the way I approach it is if it's a reputable blood test through your veterinarian and it gives us good results for environmental allergens, then I think we could do immunotherapy, which is like allergy shots or sublingual drops under the tongue. I think we could certainly do that. So for patients that have had the blood test, or even in some cases where we do it, if we get good results, then we can base a formulation off that. If the test is pretty, you know, nothing exciting sort of thing, then we definitely would do an intradermal skin allergy test, which is what we do for most dogs. We'll do intradermal tests. But as far as the online things that are out there, there's tons of things. And I will give it to the companies. Most of them have very fancy and beautiful reports with colors and color coded and little pictures of icons. I mean, it looks beautiful. But in reality, it's those tests are very questionable. And I've even been involved in, we did this thing several years back where we literally took about, I think, 5 or 6 dermatologists from around the country. We got together and we took the same hair from one dog and we all submitted it under different dog names. It was the same hair and we all got different results because we were different people from different parts of the country. So that just, when I saw that, I was like done. I knew these things were a joke, and that's not the first time that's been done. You know, there's cases where you send in blood work under 2 different dogs, but it's the same dog's blood work and you get different answers back. That's not normal. That's not right. That means these tests are flawed. So I would question those, but you know, I see commercials, they're all over, you know, social media, they're all over, you know, online sort of stuff, where there's do this test, do that test. And I just feel bad mainly because, number one, I feel like it drives clients crazy. They get this result back and they see these dogs are allergic to everything. And so they're getting rid of everything in the house. They're like, I can't have this, I can't have that, I can't use this cleaner, I can't have blueberries in the house. I'm like, your dog is fine with blueberries in the house. Like, it's just like, yeah. It drives me crazy because I feel bad for them. They're overwhelmed. It's too much information and it's not good information.
And so, the frustration level increases too, right? And so, yes. Yeah. So I got to tell you, they must come like pretty frazzled to see you, right?
Yes. Usually they come in, a lot of them have gone to more than one veterinarian. So they're kind of frustrated there, and it's not the veterinarian's fault, because if you go to them once, you can't fix allergies in one visit. Nobody can. I can't either. So that's one problem. But yeah, they usually come to me with products, you know, that have been tried, bottles of medications that are half full, which means they weren't completely administered. So that's one reason the dog didn't get better. But yeah, they're frustrated, and a lot of times rightfully so. But I feel like that's where we have a longer appointment time with our clients. So part of it, or a lot of it, is education and gaining their trust that if they do this, this is going to work. And a lot of our clients we see forever and ever and ever, which is great. I mean, that's one thing about dermatology, is we're sort of pretty similar to general practice, because we're dealing with long-term chronic disease. It's not generally, you know, life-ending, whatever we're managing. So it's not like we see them once and they're gone and they go away. A lot of them we see for years. I mean, I get to see some clients for 10 years and then they have another dog or cat and I see them again. So it's like, I have clients I've known since I've started practicing. So, which is great relations to develop. But a lot of it is getting that rapport with the client, and then they'll do stuff and then they see the results and they're kind of like, wow, my dog is the best they've ever been. And then they're on board forever. So it's good.
Wow. No, I didn't realize that the longevity, which is great. It must be great, because a lot of specialty, it's like you see them twice a year, right? Or maybe just once, right?
Yeah.
So that, yeah. So you actually develop you have a very good trust bank with your clients. You have that level of trust. That's awesome. Yeah. That's
awesome. You definitely need that. You definitely need it. Even for us, when we go to our doctors, you know, if you like your doctor, you go back. If you don't, you find a new one. I mean, that's the reality of it. So it's, you want to like your dentist, right? Nobody wants to.
Oh, yeah. You got to like your dentist.
Yeah. You know,
or your proctologist, whatever, right? You got to like those ones.
That's true.
So let's finish this discussion. Let's talk about the dreaded, you know, we were talking prior to recording about the commercials that are visible out there for particular dog foods and the whole, I'm going to say this. I think there's a bias towards over-the-counter products out there. And many discussions I have with clients about, you know, prescription diets they're frustrating. I find clients are resistant to utilizing that for whatever reason. I hear ranging from, I don't trust that company, to, you know, this is what my friend said, or my neighbor's dog has the same thing and they do this. So what is your take on food and food allergy and even client perception of this whole system?
Yes. Yeah, so food allergies, or foods in general, is very, very frustrating as far as discussion, because you can spend an hour on just that and still be confused by the ends with the client. But I think a lot of clients come in with their own research on this, and a lot of it is sparked by what's on social media, what's on TV. I mean, I know we were discussing, even some of these companies are doing ads on the Super Bowl. I mean, that's a multi-million dollar campaign, which is kind of amazing that even a product gets that far in the veterinary field, because you go back 20 years, that would have never happened. So it's, in a way, it's nice to see that veterinarians and, you know, our whole entire industry is getting exposure on such a huge watched thing on TV. But as far as the foods go, it is overwhelming. There is so much information about it. You know, what should the products be? Can I use, what is byproduct? You know, what should the first ingredient be? Well, this prescription diet doesn't even have meat as the first ingredient, or this one has chicken fat, but my dog's allergic to chicken. Can I use it? Or this one has pork fat. And, you know, it's just, it's so much. And I think that the diet is, you know, part of it's making sure the client's happy with what they're feeding, but then our job is to make sure what they're giving is safe too, because there's some products out there that probably aren't the best for them. But as far as food allergies go, they do exist. I think in general practice, they probably are addressed a little bit more than for me, because again, by the time I get the patient, usually they've either done a food trial or have attempted to do a food trial. I say attempted because there's some situations it's not going to happen. You know, you can try, but it's not going to happen. But yeah, I think with the foods, one of the issues I've seen with clients, and I know we talked about this too, is with the diets, even if you get them on a prescription diet for like a food allergy, we've been seeing a lot of backorder issues. You know, just like when the pandemic happened with many other issues, one of the things was the food, you know, supply for the dog foods, you know, and I don't know, a lot of it was probably, you know, lack of workforce in the companies or even product availability. And so clients got very frustrated during that time period where they were receiving a diet prescription for a long time, and then it went on back order, and then it didn't come back. Then it came back, then it went on back order. And I had a lot of clients that were feeding these special diets, and they just jumped ship when they couldn't get it. And, you know, it's just one of those things where once they leave, they're not coming back. So, you know, so as far as diets go, I don't even honestly carry the diets in the clinic anymore. We usually use the online sources, whether it's direct from a veterinary pharmacy or some of the other online outlets. It's just, it's become, number one, a huge issue with back orders, and it's a lot to stock foods. And contrary to a lot of clients' beliefs, we're not making, it's not a moneymaker. Diets are not moneymakers at all. So when you say you're paying $110 for the bag, it's because we're paying a lot for that bag of food. It's not making money. That's why most of us don't even, or a lot of us aren't even carrying it in the clinic anymore. So that's, it's not about the money on that one. It's just, you know,
It's never been about the money on food. Like even before these high-end specialty diets existed, it was never about the money. And food's always, I call food a pain in the butt. It's a pain in the butt. And the irony too, though, is when I hear how much clients pay for some of these over-the-counter foods, I'm going, oh my God, right? Yes. It's like the amount you're paying for this. And this could be causing this. Right. Your pet. Yeah, yeah. So well, it blows my mind.
Yeah. Well, when it's free range and organic and ancient greens, and they have a name of the chicken that was put in the bag, or, you know, the name of the bag, it's sad, but it's sort of all marketing. It's all marketing. It's just like us. We go to the market. Packaging, it says allergy free from, and they list 20 things that wouldn't have been in the product anyway, but they're on there as allergy free, and it's all marketing. And it's not to say there's a lot of great products out there, but unfortunately I think we fall into traps that are out there. And you know, but food is a huge topic with clients. They really want to talk about it, and I talk about it, but I don't spend a lot of time on it, because it would take the entire time. They're going to feed the dog what they want anyway, ultimately. And I really want to get them to deal with the allergy, which is most of the time environmental allergies for me. So I'm kind of like, all right, let's back up. We already spoke about how you're overpaying for your dog food and how you're frustrated, but yet you're giving a hydrolyzed diet, which for those of you who don't know, that means taking a protein source and enzymatically breaking it down. So that way when the immune system is exposed to that protein, like chicken or fish or soy, et cetera, the immune system doesn't react to it. Well, I can't tell you how many times they come in on these expensive hydrolyzed diets and they're putting fresh cooked chicken or worse yet, raw chicken on top of it. And I'm kind of like, you just spent $100 for the dog food bag, but yet you're putting on there the whole reason why you're giving, you know, the whole reason why you're giving this diet is to avoid that. So yeah, it's, I'm like, okay. So I think I've gotten to the point sometimes where I'm just like, okay, all right, that's fine. It's just like, I don't want to fight anymore. I just want to worry about getting your dog better. And I want to get your trust and treat them for what's really going on, which is usually the environmental allergy anyway. So.
Oh man, I'm bad. I feel bad that you have to deal with this, because I thought what I have to deal with is bad. But I'm glad you're steering me in the right direction. Well, so let's stop talking about the medical aspects. Let's talk about the pandemic. So how did it affect you and your business?
So personally, I mean, I, like probably everyone else, when the pandemic occurred, when it started, you know, kids were home from school, buildings were closing, you were limited by how many people could go in the grocery store and all this stuff. I was like, we're doomed. You know, I thought vet medicine was done. I honestly did. I was like, this is it. You know, we're going to not close down, but we're going to definitely have like another 2008 on our hands where things got really slow. And I was sort of gearing up for that. And I'm thinking, what am I going to do with all my employees? What am I going to do with the, and then honestly, within like 3 or 4 weeks, we were busier than we ever were and have continued to be busier than we ever were. So I don't really know why. I can say one thing is people were around longer, so they got to see their dogs itch all day. And they're like, oh, I got to do something about this. You know, I might not have a job right now, but I can't sleep at night, so I got to take care of my dog. You know, also there were, you know, during the pandemic, there were funds that were available for families. And so there was more money, even though a lot of them, people were out of work, there was money coming in, you know, different grants and programs out there. So they did have money. The other thing that occurred during COVID was the puppy boom. There's no question. Absolutely. People were home, and I'm guilty. We got another dog during it. So I'm right with everyone else. Is you're home. You're like, what are we going to do? We're not going on vacation. We're home 24 hours a day. You know, what do we do? Oh, let's get a dog. So, you know, I think veterinary medicine in general just got really, really busy. And on top of that, like every other industry right now, the workforce got lower and lower. And I think if any veterinarian told you they weren't looking for staff, they're lying. Everybody right. is. And everyone's looking for a veterinarian. Everyone's looking for staff. It's we honestly cannot keep up with the caseload, and that's general practice or specialty care, with the amount of doctors and nurses that we have. But if anything, during COVID, we got busier and we've continued to be busier. And initially we were doing the curbside sort of thing where dog was dropped off, and then we'd take care of them inside, talk to the owner on the phone, do the exam, talk to the owner again on the phone, bring the dog back out. And, you know, we did that for a long time, but more recently we've gotten away from that. Although some clients still like it and we do it, and that's fine. They're kind of used to that service and they're like, yeah, we just want to wait in the car. I'm like, that's fine. We can do that. So the other thing I'll say about, before I forget, is during COVID, we did start to expand what we do online. So we have online, you know, ability to order medications from our clinic. The other thing is we do, and I do this with a fair amount of clients now, is a virtual consultation, or, you know, recheck rather. I usually don't do an initial exam on virtual, on, you know, by video, but we definitely do follow up exams and clients love it. And for some of our cases where the dog or cat is really stable, it's a game changer for them. It works. Compliance is better because they live 2 hours away and they just want to follow up. And so, you know, I have a couple of those coming up next week, and, you know, we just get on a video and we talk for, you know, about 20 minutes, 30 minutes. And they show me pictures of the dog on their phone, and, you know, we're videoing, and it's a whole platform I have integrated into our software, and it works out great. So.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome. Especially for the compliance part. Yeah. Cause I forget, cause you're getting people funneling in from distances and everything like that. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. We have clients come from over 2 hours sometimes, like really, cause there's parts of this country that don't have dermatologists at all. Like they're just not there because there's not many of us. So
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And then let's touch on a couple other things. You and I are now involved in a little bit of AI business. Yeah. And so where do you see that? Where do you see the use of AI in dermatology for yourself specifically?
Yeah, so I think that is definitely something that every industry is sort of going to. I mean, an example is I needed a light bulb the other day to replace in these lights. And I'm like, I don't know what the bulb is and there's nothing on it. So my wife's like, here, take a picture of it. And she takes a picture on the AI and it tells us exactly which one to get. So I think, you know, it's definitely how it's going to happen. I don't know if it's going to make us all a bit dumber, but you know, technology's technology. But the goal with the AI, at least in the veterinary profession, is honestly to help the owner and to help the general practitioner and to help any doctor. And that is to sort of be able to one day, you know, take your phone and put it up, especially in dermatology, put it up to the sores or lesions on the dog. And then you get feedback that says, well, it's probably this, this, or this. And these are the options you have. And, you know, talk to your veterinarian and this is what we think. And I think it'll be, you know, it probably will make some owners a little bit more anxious because there's some people like that. The internet makes them very anxious because they find something and they think the worst when they see something. But for the most part, I think it's going to be comforting because it's kind of like, oh, it's probably this and it's probably benign, but I do need to get it treated. But I think it's going to be another tool. It's not going to be it's not going to be the solution for everything, but I think it's going to be a tool for both the client and the general practitioner to be able to, at least from a dermatological standpoint, you know, take their phone, take the camera, put it up to a lesion and be like, oh yeah, it's probably this, this, or this. And this is where I should maybe start, or, you know, maybe I should consult with a dermatologist or. So I think it's great. I do think it's really cool. And I'm glad to be involved. And I know we're all having fun doing it, taking pictures of these sores. Cause the whole idea is to take like 50 pictures of this one lesion. So that way the data bank, basically when it sees that, it knows it's that, kind of like with plants, you know, people are used to that. They go out with plants, or I got my wife a bird feeder that literally the birds land on it and it takes a picture or video of them and then sends to you the picture and the genus and species of what it is, the bird is. And it's just where it's going. You know, it's really cool.
Yeah, we have to embrace it because it's not going to go anywhere. We have to embrace it and see how it utilizes. But I agree. I think it's going to save those save pet parents I don't want to say wasted appointment, but an unnecessary appointment. The insurance guys are jumping on this because they don't like unnecessary appointments, right?
Yeah, right.
Jumping on this. Oh my God, yeah, they're jumping on this.
Yeah.
But it saves us. It helps us in diagnosing. It saves us an unnecessary appointment. So then we can take our limited resources and put it towards something else as well. So I think, I'm embracing it. I'm blown away by the level and where it's going on a triannual basis. Like I'm seeing this huge changes every 3-4 months. So it's amazing.
Yeah. I think it's great. So,
oh yeah, that's awesome. And I'm on a personal, I look forward to working with you on this because this is going to be really cool. It's going to be fun. Let's talk about your farm.
Yeah.
Tell me about your farm. Tell everyone about your farm and what it does for you and what it does for those animals that you bring on.
It's funny because my wife and I had this crazy dream, I guess, about 10, 15 years ago. We're like, we're going to move to a farm and we're going to have all these animals and we're going to rescue a bunch of animals. And the dream came true. So we did it. And we have a farm animal sanctuary in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. And we have, you know, sheep, pigs, goats, chickens, cattle. And, you know, it's funny because the other night, it was yesterday, we had these one cattle is separated from another because we're just introducing them. And anyway, one got out and this one's chasing this one around fields. Like, and I don't know if any of you have chased the cow before, but they're fast. I know you don't believe they're fast and they're big. And I'm chasing this cow around and there's mud everywhere. I'm going with a stick, chasing everything, just trying to get her to move. And my wife's just laughing. She's like, what the hell do we get ourselves into? Like everyone else is out to dinner on Friday night. And here we are chasing a cow around a muddy field. And anyway, it was fine. And they're great. I mean, it was all, they're all friendly. All of our animals are friendly. But so we do rescue animals and you know, they're great. I mean, it's therapy. I love being with them. You know, I'm sure it doesn't come as a shock to anybody because I'm a veterinarian, but I would much prefer spend time with animals than humans. So there's nothing against any people I know out there, but I definitely just like to be able to be with them. It's relaxing. They don't have any questions
about food,
right, nothing, you know? So to me, it's kind of a relief from everyday life. I think they appreciate what you do for them. You do develop a bond. I mean, I never thought you could develop a bond with animals. Unfortunately, I had lost a, I know it sounds crazy, but I lost a pig named Winston, who was like one of our first pigs we had. He just unfortunately needed to be euthanized last year at 10 years of age, which for an industry pig, I mean, I'm talking 1,000-pound pig, like a huge pig. That's a pretty long time, but that really hit me hard. I mean, he was my friend. Like, I know it sounds really weird because people think of bacon when they think of pigs, they don't think of a pet. And he to me was like closer to me than any dog I ever had. Like, it's just, you know, and he was smart. He listened. You know, we have our pigs, they sit when you tell them to sit, you give them a treat. I mean, and the other thing is they're clean. Like, that's another thing about pigs. Everyone thinks they're dirty. They're like the cleanest animals on the farm. Like, they are, they do not go where they sleep. It is clean. Like, that is just, you know, they know. So I think they're really smart. But my wife and I, yeah, we had this crazy dream and here we are doing it. And, you know, we have two kids and they, you know, they like it, but I think their friends like it more than they do. So it's sort of like, yeah, it's still my wife and I. And, you know, we do have some farm help too. You know, we do over the years, it's gotten pretty big. So we do have some people that help us, you know, and that's been a huge help for us. So, but it's great, you know, we love it. And, yeah.
Are you capable, like, as far as size wise, like, are you capable of like really expanding this thing or are you at your kind of maximum?
We could easily expand. We have still a lot of acreage left. It's just physically and mentally, I don't know how much we'll expand. You know, every time we say we're done, we always get something, but it's gradual. Cause that's another thing I will say to anyone out there who has this dream of having an animal sanctuary. There's a fine line between hoarding and saving. So when you have, you know, 50 pigs living in a field, that's not really saving. So our goal is to, when we adopt, because we don't buy, we always adopt, it's always a rescue. You know, we adopt or rescue them from a situation. We want to be sure that we can give them a great life and have enough space where it's, you know, they're running around, they're not crowded, it's clean. And so that's a huge thing for us. So it's making sure their life is good and that they have a lot of space to enjoy it. And yeah, I mean, we could crowd a lot more in and we have definitely numerous acres that we have even fenced in or put, you know, shelters up. So we definitely have room, but I think a lot of it is reality too. Like I said, physically it's a lot of work mentally and honestly, financially too. I mean, we do this all, this is just us. I mean, we don't have any donors, any, you know, it's just, which is fine. I'm not asking for that. I mean, we love it and I love helping them. We chose to do this, but you know, it's for example, if you have a farm animal sanctuary, you know, a lot of people go on vacation, like, oh, I got to find someone to watch after my dog. Okay. So great. Big deal. I got to find someone to look after pigs, sheep, goats, chickens, and cattle. And not everybody can do that. So you have to think about that. You know, you have to have all those plans and have, you know, people out there that are willing and able to do that. Cause not everyone knows how to work with a cow or work with a pig or, you know, things like that. So it's, yeah.
Well, that's a question I have. So you have a vet who comes in, right? You're not doing the vet yourself.
So
right?
Yeah. So I do. I always tell people I play large animal vet once in a while, but yes, I do have large animal veterinarians come in and help me that when it's beyond my means, which is often because I'm not a large animal vet. So, but I have been able, I mean, it's definitely an advantage where I can help them for minor stuff and it does save us money there, you know, being able to be like, oh, I can do that or I can do this. So, but yeah, no, we definitely have some large animal veterinarians help. And honestly, we also will use New Bolton Center, which is University of Pennsylvania's large animal hospital. We've had a few animals there. And honestly, recently we just had a really, really freaky case that's pretty rare. But one of our bulls that we rescued had castration and unfortunately got an infection, botulism after that, wow. Which is extremely rare.
Is
pretty much a death sentence for these animals. And he went down after 2.5 weeks. I mean, we couldn't get him up and we brought him to New Bolton Center and he had like literally a 5% chance to actually live. And he was in that hospital for over a month and is now back to normal. Like it was,
wow.
And he was down for over 2.5 weeks, could not get up, like laterally recumbent. So kudos to UPenn and I guess kudos to us for actually doing it because nobody would do that. but they were amazing there. They did so much for him. So that's the other thing is when you have an animal rescue, you really have to be all in. Like, you know, if I thought he was suffering, then I would have euthanized him. But he was only a year and a half old, and he really had that will. And every day he was getting better and better and better. And it was just, he became like the mascot out there to all the students and stuff. But he's recovered and he's great. So, but again, financial means to do that. Not everyone can do that. So you have to think about that.
I don't even want to ask you how much that cost. Yeah, I don't even want to know.
I mean, that's the thing though. When you get a dog or a cat, you're taking on a financial thing. And you know, it's when you have children, you're taking on a financial responsibility. When you take on farm animals, they're still your responsibility. So I think some people forget that when they want to have the dream of the animal sanctuary, they're not cheap to have. Like, it's a lot of time and a lot of work and a lot of finances. So,
man, kudos to you. Kudos to you. It was funny because I remember you on Facebook or something, you said, if anyone has old pumpkins or whatever, right, the farm animals. And I keep on thinking about it. I go, damn. So next, I got to think about you more when I do stuff
Every fall we get the neighbors in the whole area all drop off pumpkins for us. And then there's also, one or two nurseries in the area that we'll get the call, like they're cleaning out for Christmas, getting ready for Christmas decorations, come by, get all the pumpkins left. And our animals go crazy for them, especially the cows. They'll like love pumpkins, love them. They'll just like, if That's they awesome. See it, they're going nuts for it. And if you walk by, they like will follow you until you throw one over for them. You know, it's just, they love them. So. And then on a funnier note, you know, it's like, if you think about it, pumpkins love, you know, to grow in beautiful soil, and you know, cow poop, pig poop is great for pumpkins. So we get a lot of pumpkins that grow every year in the fields. They usually eat them before they grow, but we have pumpkins growing everywhere in the manure piles, in the fields, everywhere.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That's so awesome.
But usually they eat them before they're big enough. But yeah, it's interesting. We'll see like plants growing everywhere, and then little buds, and then little pumpkins here and there. So it's kind of cool.
Oh, that is really cool. That is really cool. Well, Ian, it's been great. Thanks so much for being on the show. As always, a wealth of information. And last time we did talk, I really wanted to get into the farm, and we did. And I think that is even awesome. And kudos to you for doing that. So you are at four locations, as I understand it. So you're at Garden State, you're at Animerge, you're at Blue Pearl and Levittown. Am I correct?
Yes.
And at Quakertown. So those are the four places that if any referring vets are out there, those are the four places that you can reach Ian. And then do you have a general email account? If people do have specific questions, they can reach you?
Well, if they look at the website, it's www.dermforpets.com, and it's DermForPets, dermforpets.com. And then that has all of our locations. And there's also a way to communicate through there. Like there's a contact us on there. So that's fine.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. Well, that's great. And I love the information. I learned a lot today. I'm stoked about my ear cleaning protocol recommendations for clients and pumpkins. It's all good stuff. Yeah. And I look forward to when we can physically meet and talk about the AI stuff. I think I really look forward to that.
I look forward to
that's so cool.
Stuff.
I'm so glad you came on board with that. But Ian, thanks so much for being on the show and we'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thank you. All right. Take care.
And remember, everyone, love your pet like they love you unconditionally. Have a great day. Man, that rocked. Rocked, Ian. Thanks so much, man.
Thank you.
I always think about pumpkins, so I'm going to definitely do something about it next time. But yeah, I'd love to come see the place.
Yeah, that'd definitely.
Be cool. Yeah.
Yeah, that'd be cool. Yeah, we're not that far. I don't think you're that far probably from where I am.
No.
I'm in, like near New Hope kind of.
Yeah, area, not so. At all. Not at all. Yeah. But thanks again for taking the time. I know you're super busy and I hope you enjoy the rest of the weekend.
Yeah. All right. You too. Take care.
Okay. Take care, Ian.
All right. Yep. Sure. Bye-bye.